You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things.
Okay, so tell the truth. Does the mayor get a moment of break? Does the mayor get to take a vacation this summer? Does the mayor has the mayor had a day off?
No, I tried. You know, I tried to take 3 days off, and then the riot broke out at UCLA, and I had to get on a plane and come right back home in the middle of the night. And I'm trying to take a couple of days off next week, so I'm trying to get past the protests at the synagogues. So if I can pull, and this is for you too, Zach, I want to do a five. I did a meeting yesterday, meeting on Thursday morning, that hopefully will allow me to take some days off around the 4th of July, but no.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because I'm going away for about 2 weeks, and I thought, what a luxury this is, you know, just to be able to take it. It's like 2 weeks. And I was like, wait, when is the last time you took two? Well, turns out 2 weeks is impossible. 2 days. It turns out that's impossible. That's impossible too.
That's why I have to take a security detail with me in case I need to be yanked back into town.
Yeah. You know, I do have a question about that, but I'll wait. Anyway, are you good? Before we get officially good. So welcome to Curiosity Invited, everybody. I have the great pleasure once again of speaking with my good friend, who also happens to be the mayor of Los Angeles, really, and Karen Bass. And nice to see your lovely and smiling face. You're still smiling despite all of that, all of what's going on.
I am still smiling.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, good. And Why don't I just go backwards? So you just brought up this taking a security detail with you, and I'm just so shortly after we saw each other in person, not on a screen before, there was, made national news, certainly. There was a break-in at your home. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that everybody, not just you, but everybody in your house, your family was there, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm glad that's moving its way through and everybody's safe and sound. So I know we have a very short time. Sounds like you might have a busy job or something.
Few problems here in this small town I represent.
No. Yeah, I periodically get a phone call from the mayor of Powell. There's 6,000 people in Powell. He's got more time on his hands.
What's the population of the state?
It might be just shy of or just above one congressional district, like 570,000 people, which is why there's one.
That's 200,000 less than a congressional district.
Yeah, right. That's right. It's like 700. That's right. Yeah, something like that. Isn't that wild?
It is. Yeah.
It is wild. It's a big, some people call it a small town with really long streets. Anyway, so Mayor Bass, nice to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, David.
Yeah. And I hope you don't get to ask these things so much that it's just tedious, but I know both homelessness and people living on the street and the crime situation were the big priorities. And I know you've been, your sleeves were rolled up since before you went to your office for the first day and declared a state of emergency for the city and have been vigorously moving to put people to get people off the street and put them in homes of some sort so I guess I want to know, how do you feel like you're doing with that? How do you feel that process is going? And what are you running into that's problematic that you didn't anticipate, et cetera. I know we spoke about bureaucracy, which we can talk about afterwards, but you know, are there enough places to put people? Are the places that people are being put satisfactory to everyone? I mean,
the part about it, it's important to talk about the numbers, because in Los Angeles, the numbers last year was 46,000 people who were unhoused.
Right.
About 35 of those 46 literally are on the street. The other ones are in shelters, but they're still counted as homeless. What has been very good and extremely rewarding, the most rewarding part of this job, is getting people off the streets and destroying the myth that people who are on the streets are there because they want to be, and right. that you're not going to be able to get them off. We've had the opposite problem. People are willing to leave the streets, but at the point that you raised a couple of minutes ago is where do you put them is the issue. So we've been moving people off the streets and putting them in motel and hotel rooms, which is expensive. However, sure. it's extremely expensive for people to literally be on the streets. It's expensive in terms of how much money is spent, you know, with whether it's cleanup, whether it's fires that are started, public safety issues, compromises to businesses, et cetera. So people readily leave the streets, and we have been making significant progress in tent encampments disappearing. And one thing that has been interesting is that even some of the tents have disappeared where we didn't go do outreach, but unhoused individuals know that we're going to be at a specific location. So they leave their tents several blocks away and come over to where we are so that we can house them. And so that has been working well. Bureaucracy is the biggest impediment. And I have been chipping away at the bureaucracy. But, you know, some people want to hang on to the status quo. So it's not just the rules. It's also the individuals as well. When we move people from tents into housing, a community-based organization takes over. And what we have done by calling it an emergency and making a big push on it is that we really taxed the community-based organizations way beyond their capacity. So we're having to lift their capacity at the same time as we're getting off.
These are private community-based organizations that that contract with the city to provide the care and the support that the people people need. Yeah, get it.
Exactly.
And is it so people who come from, you know, tent encampments, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, when people look from the outside, it's a tent or it's a bunch of tents. But from the inside, it's people that people are used to being around. And
well,
do they
get to be they form communities.
Yeah, exactly.
And so when you see the thing that's interesting, though, is that the size of the tent doesn't tell you how many people are there. Right. It could be one person in a very large tent, or it could be a lot of people in a tent.
Yeah.
So send out outreach workers 3 days before we move people into housing so that they can do a count, so they can talk to the people and assess their willingness or interest or what their issues are. And then on the third day, we bring a bus and we take everybody together. That's one of the reasons why we've been successful, because in the past, outreach workers would go and they'll say, okay, Mr. Jones, we have a place for you 40 miles away. And
right.
Mr. Jones says, I don't want to leave my tent community. And sure. by the way, my kids are in school over here. You move me 40 miles away and I have to take them out of school. So one of the common beliefs that people have when they drive down the street and they see unhoused individuals, you really are seeing the ones who are in the biggest crisis. You know, the senior citizen or the children are hiding. So you don't see them. You see the people who are in the most, who are in the greatest distress. And so consequently, people make a lot of stereotypes because of that.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to actually sort of relocate communities.
Yes.
Communities, which is fabulous.
Yeah, we will rent out an entire motel.
Yeah.
Take everybody to that one motel.
Yeah. That's great. That's great. And so when you say you're sort of enhancing the capacity of some of the community-based organizations, that means pouring money, know-how, getting training. What does it entail?
It is resources, but we still under-resource them. I mean, we just do. And then, you know, there's issues like the city takes a long time to pay. So the bureaucracy is an impediment on every single level. So at the same time as you're fighting to get people off the street, you're fighting to clear the brush of the bureaucracy so that you can do things faster.
Right.
So that has been, extremely rewarding. The other thing is just the overall complexity of the job. I mean, Los Angeles City, the population of Los Angeles City is almost 4 million. So as we were talking about, that is larger than many, many, many states.
Absolutely.
And so in some ways, LA functions like a state.
Yeah. Yeah. And all, yes, good and bad. Right. Indeed.
Yes, good and bad. Indeed. That's right.
And I think I read someplace, I think it was Los Angeles, but that some of the, are there homes being constructed, small homes, small houses, or is that not?
No, you probably are talking about tiny homes. And tiny homes are exactly that. They are very, very, very tiny. They're big enough for two cots, and that's about it.
That's it.
The bathrooms and kitchen facilities and all are outside. So there's a lot of, one of the things that the housing market is doing, which is positive, is there's a lot of different examples of quickly built housing. So for example, housing is being built in shipping containers. The shipping containers that go 18-wheeler trucks are on your ships coming from overseas.
Yeah.
There are modular housing that is essentially stacked up one on each other. And just because they're shipping containers and modulated homes does not mean they're ugly. Some of these are very, very nice.
Yeah.
In terms of looking at them and the quality of life.
And is that an option that the city is taking advantage of?
Oh, yes, we're doing all of that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've cut ribbons at all of the facilities.
Is it a really small ribbon as well as a really small?
A very big ribbon and a very big pair of scissors.
Yeah. Well, okay, good. That's great. And so what's the count? I mean, if you continue at this pace, I mean, you know, you don't have to give me an exact number, but if you continue at this pace, if the city continues at the current pace, how long is it going to take to?
Well, you know, the difficulty in answering that is that one issue that we are experimenting with, I can't say we have a solution just yet.
Yeah.
There are no models across the entire United States of preventing people from falling into homelessness. And the reality is, for every 200 people you get in housing, another 215 fall into homelessness. So we have a project to prevent homelessness by looking and tracking the courts when someone files for eviction. So in our city, for example, when the COVID protections and the COVID funds dried up, we had 30,000 people facing eviction last September. Now, that doesn't mean that 30,000 people will fall into homelessness, but a percentage of those will.
Right.
And a percentage of those falling into homelessness is still tremendous. So what we're doing is that we have a project that is literally reaching out to the people who are facing eviction. We have their names. We have their addresses. We're reaching out to them and we're talking to them and seeing what support they need. And we're also recruiting pro bono attorneys to represent them. So we don't have data from this project yet because this is brand new.
That's a terrifying number. That's terrifying.
It is. But the challenge is that no one really has focused on this.
Right.
I don't think that the problem is that complex. Yeah. But everybody is so busy dealing with the problem downstream that they haven't had a chance to focus on upstream.
That's deflating. And, you know, there's for every 200 out, there's 215 in, or vice versa, whatever that is. And that's just wretched.
It is, but on the other hand, I can't tell you anything more rewarding than somebody go into housing. You know, I've had people literally cry and tell me they thought they were going to die like this. They never thought they were going to get off the streets. And you can only imagine, I mean, the stereotype of somebody who is unhoused is somebody who's mentally ill or abusing substances. There's a good article in the LA Times today. I'd call your attention to it. It's an editorial. One of the fastest growing sectors of the unhoused population are people in their late 60s and 70s who, you know, worked in the service industry. They didn't have a 401k. They didn't have a pension. I don't know about where you are, David, but Social Security might buy you lunch if you have it, but it's not going to pay your rent.
No.
And so, you know, all that needs to happen is their rent's raised and then they fall out of their housing and they're on the street.
Yeah.
And needless to say, you can imagine the compromise in their health, both physical and mental.
Oh, so, and at the worst time in their lives, right? At the time in their life when they're less resourced than ever.
Right. The time of their life when society should reward them with a comfortable, you know, a way to live, but our society doesn't do that. It's easy for seniors to wind up on the street, and then the majority of the seniors that wind up on the street are women.
And
they're very racially disproportionate, by the way.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, and is that sort of the endlessly recurring stereotype of most people are on the street because they're mentally ill or they want to be. Is that as resilient as it sounds? You know, you hear it from people who could care less about the homeless population, but I remember hearing it from all sorts of places. You know, a large percentage of those people are mentally ill. Yada 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 yada. And that's been, I thought, debunked again and again. And
But, you know, look at it this way. I mean, a couple of ways to look at it. What would your mental health be if you had to?
Me? I got a problem the first day. Absolutely. Are you kidding?
So in a lot of cases, it's chicken and egg.
Yeah.
What people don't realize is that a lot of people use meth to stay awake at night so they'll survive the night. We'll try that for a couple of weeks and see if you're addicted.
Right.
So, you know, of course, there is a percentage of people that fall into homelessness because of mental health or because of substance abuse. But there's just as many that develop mental health problems and substance abuse problems because they're on the street.
Yeah.
The bottom line is that, you know, those stereotypes allow people to then be disconnected and feel they have no responsibility.
Right.
Because
that's
individual's fault. What about the fact that if you are in the foster care system, when you turn 18 or 21, we make you homeless.
Literally. Goodbye. It's been great.
Put you on the street.
Yeah.
And guess what? 4 or 5 months of couch surfing. And then the next thing you know, that young person is on the street. Another popular belief in Los Angeles, by the way, is that the majority of the people that are homeless come from other states, especially coal states, because the weather's so wonderful here. And I think Angelenos love that stereotype, again, because the stereotypes allow people to say, I have no responsibility. I don't need to think about that. But you know what? A common thing with Angelenos, and this might be everywhere, okay, but I can just talk about my city. When you ask somebody where they're from, they will tell you where they were born. And so you say, well, where are you from? I'm from Chicago. Well, how long have you lived in Los Angeles? Oh, 40 years.
30 years, you're right.
I'm from Los Angeles.
Exactly.
I didn't ask where you were born.
Right.
So it allows people then to say, well, number one, they're not from here. Number two, they're there because of their drug abuse or because of their mental illness. Let me turn the page, change the subject. I have nothing to do with that. And there's nothing that can be done about that.
Okay. So last question about this, and I don't want to beat it into the ground, but because I think it's just inspiring what's going on there. But is that $1 billion that you devoted on day one before you hit the before you made it to your office? Is that enough?
No.
No.
No, it's not enough, especially if you look at what the $1 billion goes for. That's encompassing everything related.
Yeah, no, I know. I know.
Okay. So, you know, we spend $300 million a year cleaning up sanitation, because encampments, as you can imagine, create a lot of debris. You know, fires are started in encampments for people to keep warm. Police are called. So there's a lot of money that is spent because people are homeless. But I do have to raise something, David, that you might not be aware of. Any minute now, the Supreme Court is going to make a decision on a case involving a city in Oregon. And if the Supreme Court upholds what that city did, we could potentially see a whole wave of criminalization of the homelessness spread across the country. The city in Oregon called Grants Pass started issuing tickets for people who were unhoused, $270 a ticket. So needless to say, you can accumulate a lot of tickets. And if you do, then you are banned from being in a specific area. And if you return to that area, or if your tickets go into warrants, then you could be incarcerated.
Right.
And so I'm not really worried about this in the city of Los Angeles, but I am very worried about it in cities across the country and many in California, too. You know, California is known as a liberal state, but you very well know that drive an hour outside of Los Angeles and you're in a very conservative area.
Yes, indeed.
So because people get number one, do not understand who are homeless, and they essentially demonize them by saying it's their fault, then it's easy to say, well, we've tried everything. Just lock them away and throw away the key. The reality is
which is even more expensive.
Well, if you start incarcerating people, number one, they're not going to stay incarcerated long. But you want to talk about spending money?
Unbelievable.
It costs a ton of money. We already do this. This is the way we take care of mental illness in the United States. It is a crime to be mentally ill, and you are incarcerated repeatedly. So here we go again, repeating what we did in the 90s, policy that ushers in a wave of incarceration. And then 5 or 10 years down the line, we go, oh my God, this is terrible. Look what happened. Well, how about stopping it before it starts? So stay tuned. Given the nature of this Supreme Court, I cannot imagine where they would not uphold the right of cities to punish people for being unhoused. Right. Very, very important. And it'll be important for the people that listen to your podcast to speak out mightily against this and to make sure that in whatever city they are in, that this does not happen. A lot of times when policies happen, people don't realize the policy is happening until they see the horrible effects. And that might be 5 or 10 years down the line.
Yes. And the, I mean, then the policies, I mean, there's such a long history of that. And it's it's been in our past. And the idea that it's coming back is just wild. It's wild. Yeah. In all of the ways that it's wild, legally, morally, it's just like, what?
Who thinks
this is a good idea? So yeah, I want to have this piece of the conversation, and I know it's short time, so Zach, who I've met before and met just a moment ago, your deputy mayor for communications, so he puts out those email things. And the last one was the LA Times giving you, little snippets of a report card. And I don't know about you, but I used to, when we knew each other way back when, and you were on the board, I don't know if you remember this, but I don't know if it was in place when you were there, they would give me an annual report card of like 40 things on the report card that board members would rate me on. Mm-hmm. And most of those things, all were probably important, but most of those things, the people who were doing the rating had no way of really knowing how I was. So it just felt like I'm stuck in some bizarro, bad movie here. So, I love when I read good things about you, and And all of them is like, yeah, this, of course, we knew that. Everybody knew that. That's why they voted for her. Come on. So rate yourself. What's something you're hitting out of the park? And what's something you wish whatever your role there, you were more successful with?
Well, I think what I feel I've hit out of the park are the relationships, which is absolutely key. Solidifying the relationships on the national, state, county, and city level, and sharing those resources. So, you know, bringing delegations to DC of city council members, or a few weeks ago, I took 50 mayors to the Hill, not just for show, but we are focusing on very specific areas of public policy, and we've been able to come back and announce very specific changes. And what is the ongoing frustration, of course, I mentioned at the top, just the layers of bureaucracy that really contribute to people being on the street. And I say bureaucracy in general because it is a challenge regardless of what I'm dealing with. If I'm dealing with climate change, if I'm dealing with transportation, if I'm dealing with procurement and small businesses, the city has an entrenched bureaucracy. And if you think about it, one of the reasons for that, elected officials and appointed officials pass policies all the time, but they never put in a time. So in other words, let's evaluate this policy.
Take a look at this, yeah.
And see if it's working. Yeah. Metrics are never put in. What is the outcome and goal? And so just taking the issue of homelessness, there's policies stacked up on each other that are 30, 40 years old and make absolutely no sense. Let me mention one of them. If you're a veteran and you get veterans benefits, we count as income. And then we say you make too much money, so we won't give you housing. So we literally have vacancies in housing because a person's veterans benefits is counted as income. So when I took 50 mayors back to DC, it was to lobby to change that. And so that change is underway now. So being able to deliver results by the slogan that we say here, locking arms, is really a conscious strategy of how one brings about changes in policy. And I think that has been demonstrated repeatedly. And it also has exposed layer after layer of bureaucracy. It's like, oh, you changed this. Oh, but you have to change that too.
and are there places where you can sort of unblock the dam?
Yeah.
Is it a legal process? Is it like a slow process to do that? Doing that anymore?
Well, absolutely. I can just say we're not doing that anymore. But David, I have to know it's there.
Yeah.
So if somebody would tell me these are your 4,000 layers of bureaucracy, have at it, then okay. Unfortunately, it's been a journey discovering. It's like, oh, okay, you fixed that one, but you didn't know that this one was there.
And
I'm not saying that it's somebody is deliberately withholding information.
No, I get that.
It has been in place for years and people aren't thinking about it. Right. So yes, it's discovering the barriers. Now, some of them I can just say, we're not doing that anymore. Some of them do require a change in law.
Right.
And some of them require a change in administrative policy. And I've had to discover each layer.
That's a good thing for a volunteer committee. A volunteer committee, no judge, there's people who are really smart, looking for idiotic, unproductive policy. So
I always compare it to an onion. It's like peeling an onion. But when you peel an onion, you cry.
Yeah. Yes, you do. And there's always another layer.
Exactly.
There's always another layer. Oh, you can't do that because. Crime.
Yes. Crime. There is such a thing.
There is. And are you still getting beat up about it?
No. People are upset about it. But, you know, crime is a very interesting subject because it is very subjective and it is not connected to data. So some people will try to say, but crime has gone down. Well, but if your house was just broken into, there's crime crisis.
Yes.
So somehow we have to stop framing it in just data. So I will tell you, the data shows that crime has gone down.
Yes.
The perception is that's not true. So I have to address both.
Right.
So I have opened up an office of community safety that focuses on preventing crime from happening, especially violent crime. And then I also have an office for public safety, which is your more traditional office,
right,
which police, fire, emergency, et cetera.
All right. And I know you're going to be looking at the clock. So, and Zach's probably looking at the clock already. So let me ask you one more question. Is there any preparation happening at the city level? This may sound stupid, but I don't think it is. For the possibility, Ed, of Donald Trump being reelected as president of the United States and the various policies that they are promising to put in place. Is there any?
No, and honestly, I'm not sure there should be because I went 4 years up close and personal with the Trump administration being in D.C. There's no point to do that because he is so erratic that he would just be spending a lot of energy when he could go someplace completely different. My focus is on preparing for the World Cup and the Olympics and understand that that is in the context that he could win as well. Because if he were to win, those events would be devastating, you know, because he does not like California and particularly does not like Los Angeles. So my focus is on making sure that those come off okay. But also, on the other side, I can't bear the thought that the country would make such a profound mistake that would impact the entire planet, because it does. And I know President Biden, I had the privilege of speaking with him a couple of months ago, and he told me that world leaders come up to him and say, please do not make a mistake again. Our democracy depends on it. Because if you note what happened during those 4 years, you had authoritarian regimes elected all across Europe
across
a lot of different countries. And so European leaders, Asian leaders, African leaders are worried that if we do not get this election right, that we impact their ability to govern as well.
Well, and, you know, recent elections in Italy and throughout,
right.
I mean, it's there. It's a crisis. Well,
but we have to have our people understand.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to take a symbolic vote because I'm mad at Biden, and I'm going to vote for him. So over here, understand if you do that, you are voting for Trump.
Totally.
Understand if you don't go vote because you're not happy, you're all voting. Right. That's what you're doing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, I can see our time is up. And I can see standing around you. So, hey, Karen, I'm not sure when the next time is I'm coming to Los Angeles, but we have to have a complete dinner and wine next time.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
That
was a terrible evening.
That was yes, man. And someday you'll tell me about what happened.
But I will.
The wine that you left over was excellent. So thank you. Hey, thank
all
you
right.
For coming to talk. And I love you, and you take care of yourself.
Thank you. Likewise.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.